It was several days after Gaza was captured that he was sent in. Chaos reigned. Quote, Israeli soldiers and border police were there with no clear orders and no clear command center, which led to rampant disorder and looting, end quote. My father quickly set up his command, arrested the looters, collected arms from the locals, and restored order. He set up guidelines to restoring basic services like healthcare and education. He conducted a census that accounted for each family, whether they were refugees, and if so, from what town or village they had been exiled. The report had accounts of education levels, property, livestock, and a whole host of information about the place and its people. As military governor of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, my father realized that he knew virtually nothing of their language, culture, or their way of life. He did not like the fact that he needed translators in order to communicate with the people he governed, so he made a personal decision to study Arabic, receiving a bachelor's degree in Arabic from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He said, in conversations with the locals, I was amazed to learn that they were not seeking vengeance for the hardship we caused them, nor did they wish to get rid of us. They were realistic and pragmatic and wanted to be free, end quote. Under immense pressure from the Eisenhower administration, Israel was forced to give up the conquered territories in March of 1957. Although in those days Israel was receiving no money from the U.S. government, when the American president gave the word, my father had 2 weeks to get out. He was out in 2 days, but he was deeply troubled. My mother and my sister Nurit told me many times that this issue tormented him for months. Nurit said he could not sleep at night and he would not talk of anything else, and he would talk of nothing else. My mother told me similar stories. I was not yet born, but I can imagine his frustration when he learned he would have to go back on his word. I heard him talk about his many, I heard him talk about this many years later, saying, I was assured by my superiors that I could tell the people of Gaza that if they cooperated with us, they would not be returned to Egypt. The local leadership believed me and cooperated, and then we left Gaza, and then when we left Gaza, they paid a heavy price for this. In an article he wrote after he retired, he brought this up again. Here's the extraction. As the one whose destiny it was to inform the leaders of the towns and villages in Gaza on that cold day in April 1957 that the Israeli government decided to forsake them, I can testify to the looks on the faces of people who at first did not want to believe that they were, did not want to believe what they were hearing, and then realized what they had brought upon themselves by believing the Israeli government. Footnote here from Mati Peled, The Palestinian Problem, in Ma'ariv, June 27, 1969. Continuing now. My father's next major assignment was commander of the Jerusalem Brigade, which secured and protected West Jerusalem's precarious border with Jordanian-controlled East Jerusalem. Jerusalem was not just another region. Jews, Christians, and Muslims had a deep regard for the city, which meant that my father had dealings with diplomats and religious leaders from all around the world. It was a highly sensitive diplomatic post as well as a difficult military one. In the early 1960s, he served as special advisor on armaments to the Deputy Minister of Defense, who at the time was Shimon Peres. This was the period when, under Peres' supervision, Israel began developing its nuclear weapons program, early 1960s. It was one role about which my father never spoke, and about which I could find no information, presumably because of its highly classified nature. And another old black and white photograph of the commander of the Jerusalem Brigade with Israel's prime minister at the time, David Ben-Gurion. Continuing with the text. In 1964, when I was 3 years old, my father was promoted to Major General, Aluf in Hebrew, as Chief of Logistics in the Israeli Army. This is the highest rank in the Israeli Army with the exception of one person, the Army Chief of Staff. His responsibilities included armaments, technology, logistics, the medical corps, weapons, and other purchases, and overseeing an enormous budget. The job he wanted was head of Army Intelligence, and since he was the only general who spoke Arabic at the time, it would have been a logical choice. But Chief of Logistics was an important position that carried a great deal of responsibility, and the state of logistics in the Army was in dire need of reform. So Army Chief of Staff Yitzhak Rabin nominated him to that position, and he remained in it for 4 years. He felt that war was imminent and that the logistical operation needed a modernization. And so, in the first 100 days of his command, he planned a complete overhaul of the system. A book on the IDF, IDF again stands for Israeli Defense Forces, a book on the IDF Logistics Command that was published years later by the IDF described his reform in this in these two sentences. Quote, in a fashion that is uncharacteristic of the Army, the discussion he led were short and efficient, and within 6 months of him taking command, the reforms were approved by Chief of Staff Rabin. Within 3 months after that, the reforms were implemented, end quote. The description ends by stating that only an officer with a broad vision, an understanding of the needs of the military, and an extraordinary determination in implementation, as General Matti Peled possessed, is capable of executing an overhaul of such dimensions, end quote. Let me stop here again and remind everyone that the author, who is the son of General Peled, the son's name is Miko. Obviously, Miko feels it necessary to completely describe the dimensions of his father's duties and how he related personally, how his father related personally to the orders and positions of responsibility given to him in order to set up, to describe the history of how it got to the point where General Matti Peled resigned from the Israeli military and became a peace activist, wanting to reconcile with the Palestinian Arabs there. Okay, I'll try not to have to interrupt again to remind people of that, but I kind of sense that this is material that is not terribly interesting to a lot of you, but this book clearly is an important book, and we're getting close to the point now of General Peled's resignation. Okay. Continuing with Chapter 2. On Fridays, my father would come home from work early, and after dinner, he would sit in the living room and turn on our beautiful, large wooden radio. I was no more than 4 or 5 years old, but I remember it like it was yesterday. He would sit there, still in uniform, and listen to speeches in Arabic given by President Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt and other Arab leaders of the time. My father spoke Arabic fluently by then. I remember hearing the massive applause the speakers received and thinking that they sounded like a lot of chess pieces being tossed around in a box. Even though I could not understand a word, I would sit in complete silence as he listened for hours to these speeches. He was absorbed in what he was doing and did not acknowledge me or anyone else that may have been there. Still, I felt as though I was witnessing something very important. Soon, war was on the horizon again. In the late spring of 1967, Egypt's President Nasser expelled the United Nations peacekeeping forces that had been monitoring the ceasefire between the two countries from the Sinai Peninsula. He sent Egyptian troops across the Suez Canal and into the demilitarized Sinai Peninsula. And he threatened to blockade the Straits of Tiran and not permit Israeli ships to proceed toward the Israeli port city of Eilat. These were acts that blatantly violated the terms of the ceasefire that was signed between Egypt and Israel. The army was calling it a plausible casus belli, or justification for war. According to documents I found in the IDF archives and other sources, the Soviet government fed misinformation to the Egyptians, claiming that Israel was planning a surprise attack against Syria. The Soviets claimed that Israel had amassed troops on the border with Syria. Syria and Egypt had a mutual security pact, and President Nasser had to act in defense of his Syrian allies. As the Israeli cabinet was considering its options, on May 26, 1967, the Russian Prime Minister sent the Israeli Prime Minister, Levi Eshkol, a letter through the Soviet embassy in Tel Aviv, calling for a peaceful resolution to the conflict. When the Russian ambassador presented Prime Minister Eshkol with the letter, Eshkol invited the ambassador to see with his own eyes that the claim had no merit and that Israeli troops were not amassed at the Syrian border. The army was recommending that Israel initiate a preemptive strike against Egypt. The cabinet was hesitant and wanted time to explore other options before committing to a full-scale war. Things came to a head in a stormy meeting of the IDF General Staff and the Israeli cabinet that took place on June 2nd, 1967. And a footnote here. Minutes of the meeting between IDF General Staff and the Israeli cabinet at IDF headquarters on June 2, 1967. So taken directly from the minutes of the meeting, the Israel Defense Forces and Defense Establishment Articles, IDFA, Tel Hashomer Military Base. Continuing with the text. After opening remarks, my father told the cabinet, in no uncertain terms, that the Egyptians needed a year and a half to 2 years in order to be ready for a full-scale war. The other generals agreed that the Israeli army was prepared and that this was the time to strike another devastating blow. And I'll add here, to strike another devastating blow in consequence to Israel's attack on Egypt 11 years prior in 1956. Continuing. During this meeting, my father said to the Prime Minister, quote, Nasser is advancing an ill-prepared army because he is counting on the cabinet being hesitant. He is convinced that we will not strike. Your hesitation is working in his advantage, end quote. In his reply to my father, the Prime Minister said, the cabinet must also think of the mothers who are likely to become bereaved. The generals were getting more and more frustrated and tensions ran high. Rabin, who was a heavy smoker, was said to have suffered nicotine poisoning and a nervous breakdown. They all knew what my father knew, which was that victory was imminent. In his role as chief of logistics, my father also warned that a prolonged mobilization of reservists, who had already been called up by then and comprised a significant percentage of Israel's workforce, would cripple the country's economy, perhaps even cause it to collapse, unless the cabinet acted decisively. Quote, the army morale is high, and we will be victorious whether we strike today or in 3 weeks. But the Israeli economy cannot hold for very long. We are not prepared, nor are we meant to hold through an extended period of waiting, my father said. General Ezer Weizmann, a lifelong friend of his, threatened to resign his post as deputy chief of staff. General Ariel Sharon, who many years later would be prime minister, said that Israel must engage in a preemptive strike against the Egyptian army, quote, and destroy it entirely without delay. According to all accounts I had heard over the years by people who were present at this meeting, my father's words to the prime minister were particularly scathing. He demanded an explanation, quote, why must this army, which had never lost in battle, endure such an insult by the cabinet, end quote. This exchange between the two power centers was later known as the General's Coup. Many years later, when the issue came up in public debate, I asked my father, what do you say to the claim that this was a coup? Nonsense, he retorted in his typically dismissive way. He did not like to have his commitment to the state of Israel questioned, and when it was, he made his displeasure known. But he believed firmly in the superiority of the civilian government and in the rule of law. He defended his actions in speeches and articles many times. His exact words were, the army leadership had an obligation to advise the cabinet and to make their point clear. Just as the other arms of government had obligations to advise in matters of state or economics, so were we obliged as military experts to give our expert opinion. In an article he published in Ma'ariv on June 15, 1973, he mentioned this again, quote, I can testify that there was not a single senior officer in the army who questioned the government's undeniable authority to decide or the army's duty to obey, end quote. Still, as one reads the transcript of that meeting, it is obvious my father spoke to the prime minister in a harsher tone than would otherwise be acceptable in a civilian democracy. I heard the story of this meeting more than once related by Ezer Weizmann, who we fondly called Azer, himself when he visited us. Quote, you should have seen your father, he recalled with enthusiasm. He knew how to pound on the table and get the job done. The whole thing visibly pleased Azer to no end. Well, the generals made no progress and the members of the cabinet chose to wait. They preferred to see the impasses resolved through diplomatic means, and a tug of war with unimaginable proportions ensued. This was more than a difference of opinion on how to resolve the crisis. A generational difference factored in as well. The Israeli army generals were in their early to mid-40s, and most of them volunteered in their youth to serve in the Palmach. All but five were Israeli-born, and they were zealous in their belief that Israel must always be decisive and forceful. The members of the cabinet, on the other hand, were mostly in their 60s. Most were from my grandfather's generation, had immigrated to Israel from Eastern Europe, and had fresh recollections of Jews being persecuted and killed. After all, this was taking place only 30 years after the Holocaust. The army decided to announce that, quote, the delay in attack is due to diplomatic considerations, but the existential threat remains imminent, end quote. Israeli citizens were led to believe that the Arab armies were coming to rape and murder them, as the Nazis had done less than three decades earlier. The government was pressured by public demands on the one hand and by the generals on the other to act decisively. Eshkol, who acted as defense secretary in addition to his capacity as prime minister, something that is quite common in Israeli administrations, was pressured to give up his role as defense secretary. This was a personal insult for him as well as a major political setback. He called the highly admired former army chief of staff and Ben-Gurion protege, General Moshe Dayan, into the cabinet as minister of defense. Eshkol then called the opposition parties into a national unity government, which authorized a preemptive strike against Egypt. Once again, the militant approach gained the upper hand. Well, there is a intra-chapter sectional pause here, so I think this is a good time to break for some musical entertainment. Again, played on the Arabic instrument, stringed instrument, the oud, although this is from my one CD featuring oud music, which happens to be played by a Greek American and Greek style. I'll just load that sucker up. This is the weekend edition of Mideast Migraines on Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming at online at freakradio.org and transmitting pretty much to the whole of the city of Santa Cruz at 101.3 on the FM dial. I'm waiting for the music to pipe up here, do what it's supposed to do. Okay, how about beginning with Lucky Seven here? Yeah. Except I'm not sure if that's seven here. Try seven. Thank you.
or over 50 years, by no means 15 years old.
Thank you.
No. Alrighty. I was playing it on my home personal computer. I have to use programs and devices and things that I'm not familiar with, and seems to me I might have replayed the same item twice in a row. That's the new Power Media program from Microsoft or whoever the hell puts that together. It's from the Greek-American CD Wooden Heart. The artist whom I saw in concert a couple of years ago, and Ben Lomond, his name is Mavroti Kontanis. Wooden Heart by Mavroti Kontanis. Very nice. Back to the book, folks. Reading for today is, we're currently on chapter 2 of Miko Peled's The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, 2014, JustWorldBooks.com. And chapter 2, which is Ernest Lee. Chapter 2 here describes the author's father, Mati Peled, General Mati Peled. Now the late Mati Peled. So I just want to make sure I'm on the right page here. Yep. And you are listening to the Saturday edition, weekend edition of Mideast Migraines program on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, streaming online at freakradio.org. We come to you every Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific time. There is also the other edition of Mideast Migraines every Monday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Pacific time. Continuing with chapter 2 of The General's Son. I was 5 years old at the time, but I remember the ensuing flurry and the preparations for the war. The adults, unable to conceal their worry, the news broadcasts playing more often than usual on the newspaper headlines, striking even my 5-year-old eyes as more intense. My father was spending his nights and days at Army headquarters. My older brother, Yoav, by then a lieutenant and a platoon commander in the Armored Corps, I take that to mean tanks, was in active duty, and we neither saw nor heard from him. I was particularly anxious because we were notified that Motza Elite, where we lived, was in grave danger. Less than a mile from our house is an ancient Crusader castle called, plainly, the Castel, K-A-S-T-E-L. In 1948, in a bloody battle that took place there between the Haganah forces and Palestinian fighters, Palestinian commander and national hero Abdelkader el-Husseini was killed, and his death was a severe blow to the Arab forces. It was said that the Arabs planned to take the castle and avenge the death of el-Husseini. What did that mean? Would they come and kill us all? I kept my worries to myself, relieved to see that the army positioned an artillery battery in the valley nearby. Our house had no bomb shelter and may well have been the only one in the entire country without one. Bomb shelters are useless and unnecessary, my father insisted. And no amount of convincing would sway him to build one. When he made up his mind about something, he seldom offered an explanation. He had no patience for people who questioned his knowledge or authority as an expert. So even though our house had only recently been built, there was no place for us to sit when the sirens went off. We did have one spot in the house that was somewhat guarded. The small downstairs bathroom, situated on the ground floor and directly underneath the upstairs bathroom, was the safest place in the house. So my mother and sisters and I, who were alone at home during the war, would rush to sit there whenever we heard the sirens. To give the place some dignity, my mother put a vase with flowers in it, and she hung an autographed photo of David Ben-Gurion on the wall. The bathroom was barely large enough to fit two people at a time. Our house was an imperfect shelter in other ways. Because my father wanted us all to be able to enjoy the view of the Judean hills surrounding our home from the kitchen and living room, there were massive glass doors on the main floor. This meant danger of glass being shattered. So I helped Osi and Nurit, his siblings, to plaster the windows with strips of cloth. During the day, it all seemed like some sort of festive occasion, because there was no school and my sisters and I were home together. But at night I was frightened. From my bedroom window I saw the endless stream of helicopters bringing wounded soldiers to the Hadassah hospital that sits on a hill directly across from our house. I would get up and go down the corridor to my mother's bedroom, only to find that my sisters were there too. We all tried to calm our fears by cramming into my mother's bed. I was a child. I had no inkling what war meant. I just knew that we Israelis were heroes, and we would surely win. Like other Israeli children, I was taught that we were descendants of the Maccabees, who beat the entire Greek Empire, and King David, who was but a child when he killed Goliath the Philistine. I knew that even though we were few and they were many, we won every war since Israel was established. I heard stories from my mother about the brave fighters of the Haganah who fought the British and the Arabs with their superior weapons. We outsmarted and beat them every time. As it turned out, the whole thing did not last long. The surprise attack led to the total destruction of Egypt's air force, the decimation of the Egyptian army, and the reconquest of the Gaza Strip and the Sinai Peninsula in a matter of days. Israeli army intelligence confirmed that the Syrian and the Jordanian armies were no match to the IDF. After the campaign against Egypt went smoothly, the field commanders, in collusion with Moshe Dayan, decided to take the West Bank and the Golan Heights, two regions Israel had coveted for many years. Both had strategic water resources and hills overlooking Israeli territory. The West Bank contained the heartland of biblical Israel, including the, quote, crown jewel, the old city of Jerusalem. The fact that the West Bank and the old city of Jerusalem remained in Arab hands in 1948 was a sore spot for many of the senior officers. So when the opportunity arose again, they acted swiftly and decisively. They referred to it as, quote, finishing the job. in 1953 when my father was still a young lieutenant colonel. Moshe Sharet had invited him to speak in front of a delegation of American Jews. Both Sharet and Ben-Gurion were present and both expressed their delight at the eloquence and the content of the lecture. In his memoirs, Sharet writes that my father said in no uncertain terms that the army is preparing for war, and I quote here, in order to complete the conquest of the land of Israel and to push Israel's eastern border to its natural location on the banks of the Jordan River, end quote. When the opportunity arose, the army did this without waiting for orders from the civilian authorities. In 6 days, it was all over. Arab casualties were estimated at more than 15,000. Israeli casualties were 700. And the territory controlled by Israel had nearly tripled in size. Israel had in its possession not only land and resources it had wanted for a long time, but also the largest stockpiles of Russian-made arms outside the Soviet Union. Israel had once again asserted itself as a major regional power. I remember the jubilation. The radio played victory songs and Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, Jerusalem of Gold, written by Naomi Shemer, became an international hit. My father finally came home, and there was news that my brother Yoav was okay. In a sheer coincidence, he and my father met in the field after the Sinai Desert was taken. My mother has a photo taken by a friend showing a very young and tired Yoav, full of dust from the desert, and my father facing one another and talking. Then there were the ceremonies. I recall we went to Army headquarters in Tel Aviv as the victorious generals were all awarded their victory pins. In a photo I have and treasure, Israel's president, Zalman Shazar, Dod Zalman, is surrounded by the entire army general staff with an autograph of each of the generals at the bottom. I was so proud at that time, I felt that I could fly. I had no idea that my father was concerned about any unintended negative consequences this victory posed to the Jewish state. The late Ze'ev Schiff, who was Israel's most prominent military analyst, would later say that in his role as chief of logistics, my father's contribution to the war's success was unprecedented and cannot be overstated. He and his comrades, who as young officers made the victory of 1948 possible, were now the generals who led the victory of 1967 and the complete return of the historic Eretz Israel, or Land of Israel, after 2,000 years to Jewish hands. And on top of that, this was taking place less than 30 years after Nazi-controlled Europe was systematically murdering Jews. But this massive conquest of lands troubled my father. When he was pushing for the war, he'd imagined it would be a limited war with Egypt to punish the Egyptians for their breach of the ceasefire and to assert Israeli legitimacy and military might. Taking the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and Golan Heights was never part of any official plan. In an article in the Daily Ma'ariv, journalist Chaim Hanegbi vividly describes the first weekly meeting of the general staff after the Six-Day War. Footnote to that, Chaim Hanegbi, Peled, His Mouth and His Heart, Ma'ariv, April 7, 1995. Continuing with text. He states that Chief of Staff Yitzhak Rabin and the other generals were beaming with the glory of victory. But when the meeting was nearing its end, my father spoke. Never one to rest on his laurels, he cleared his throat and in his unmistakably dry and analytical manner, he spoke of the unique chance the victory offered Israel to solve the Palestinian problem once and for all. Quote, for the first time in Israel's history, we are face to face with the Palestinians, without other Arab countries dividing us. Now we have a chance to offer the Palestinians a state of their own, end quote. He later also claimed with certainty that holding on to the West Bank and the people who lived in it was contrary to Israel's long-term strategy of building a secure Jewish democracy with a stable Jewish majority. If we kept these lands, popular resistance to the occupation was sure to arise, and Israel's army would be used to quell that resistance, with disastrous and demoralizing results. He concluded that this would turn the Jewish state into an increasingly brutal occupying power and eventually into a binational state. My father said all this as the gun barrels were still smoking and before Israel began its settlement project in the West Bank and Gaza. The other generals listened, but they did not want to discuss the issue. They claimed the Palestinians would never settle for the West Bank and Gaza and would demand more land. So he proceeded to bring intelligence reports that showed clearly that an overwhelming majority of Palestinians thought as he did. Finally, Yitzhak Rabin took him aside privately and told him it wasn't the right political climate to discuss this. Even though I was only 6 years old when my father retired from the IDF, my entire life had been affected by his military career. In Israeli terms, where the army is regarded above all else, and the generation of 1948, or the Palmach generation, have all but been made into gods, it was no ordinary career. It was during these years that I was infused with patriotism and a belief in the Zionist cause. Having been born an Israeli Jew at this time in history, I had a desire to fulfill my destiny and to serve when my turn came. At the time, I wanted very much to be a hero and a great general like my father. End of chapter 3. Miko Peled's The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Now, if I read my numbers correctly, this show, has already gone over time. Or, let's see, I've got roughly 45 plus 50 minutes. That would normally be an hour. Well, no, not overtime. Got about 25 minutes left. If I doing the numbers in my head here. So let us begin chapter 3. My name is Ren Tawil, or Lawrence Tawil, your friendly local neighborhood Santa Cruz County-ish Palestinian American, bringing you what is quite obviously a very different narrative to what most Americans are used to concerning the Israelis and the Palestinians and the Jews, Muslims, Christians, and others in that part of the world. And along those lines, it is critically important to keep in mind that the book I'm reading to you was written by a man who I believe is now, let's see, 70, 80, 90, oh, he's over 50 years old now. An Israeli Jew born and bred in Jerusalem, and as just described in his first half dozen years of life, the young boy was completely enveloped in love of all things Israeli and all things Jewish, and in this notion of Zionism, to reclaim the land for the Jews and the Jews only. At such an impressionable young age of 5 and 6, and certainly before that, it was impressed upon him that there was nothing wrong with that, that this was a natural course of events. So we have a book here, The General Son, written by an Israeli Jew who now lives in Southern California with his family. He is no longer a Zionist. And he is by no means a self-hating Jew. That's a terrible expression that's been making the rounds in recent years by those who still favor Zionism and still cling to the shirt tails of Israel and want to completely dismiss even Jewish critics of Israel. They call the rest of us who are not Jewish anti-Semites. That's normal. And even Jews in their midst, both in Israel and outside of Israel, including in America, who are critical of the Israeli state as self-hating Jews. That's because they have no other rational, intelligent criticism of these individuals. If you cannot attack the criticism itself, the contents of the criticism, the things that they talk about, then they will attack the character of the people saying it, or their background, or anything else that they think they can poo-poo successfully. Okay, let's continue. Chapter 3, Against the Current, Academia and Activism. I think it's going to get a little more juicy now and a lot more current. Against the Current, Academia and Activism. My father planned to retire immediately after the 1967 war, but was asked by the new Army Chief of Staff, Chaim Bar-Lev, to stay another year. There was a need for major armament and logistics organization after the war, so he agreed to stay and get the job done. But my father had no interest in governing an occupied nation, and he was eager to move on with his life. So in 1968, he opted to retire from the Army and embark on a much-anticipated academic career. He donated his huge military library to the IDF and filled his study with books on Arabic literature. Filled his study, meaning the study in his house, the room, and filled his study with books on Arabic literature, replacing his huge military library. Israeli military. Okay, continuing. The transition from the intensity of military life to civilian life is not easy, and naturally it took my father some time to adjust. The first few years after he retired from the military, he would not answer the phone. He was used to having a secretary. That was understandable. If I answered the phone, I would need to find out who was on the other end. And once I told my father, he would sharply ask, "Well, what does he want?" To which, of course, I had no answer. At one point, he decided to answer the phone by himself, but always in a tone that suggested that he was being pulled away from something important. And indeed he was. Mati Peled was always doing something important. His greatest joy was work, and he took himself and his work extremely seriously. Interruptions were never welcome. Upon his retirement, my father had lucrative career options. As IDF Chief of Logistics, he headed an immense logistic, administrative, and financial organization, and he did this with unprecedented success. When he retired, He was only 45 years old, and already considered an enormous hero. He could have done pretty much anything he wanted to at that time. He fielded offers to head some of Israel's largest and most successful corporations. He also had several attractive options in government and politics, but he found none of those appealing. He did not believe that one should choose work because of money or position. One's work, he used to say, should be determined by principles, by the ability to contribute, or by one's own interests in life. For him, building an army for the Jewish state was based on principle. Becoming a scholar of Arabic literature fulfilled his interests. Being involved in politics and being an advocate for Palestinian rights was his contribution to the moral fiber of the state that he fought to establish for the Jewish people. When I was old enough to appreciate the benefits of having money, I asked him why he turned down those lucrative offers. "What do you mean, why? Do you think I should spend my life manufacturing zippers?" Zippers was his way of referring to anything that he thought was of little consequence to the world. So immediately after my father retired from the army, our family moved to Los Angeles for 3 years in order for him to pursue his second career as a professor of modern Arabic literature. During this time, he managed to complete his PhD at the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA. I was 6 years old, and I was ecstatic to go to America. I would show off my vast knowledge about America to my friends. Quote, "In America, they have cars with automatic transmission and phones where you can see the person on the other end of the line through the phone." End quote. I actually imagined the stick shift moving on its own, and I was seriously disappointed when I learned that it was not like that at all. Quote, "Plus we fly in an airplane to get there. Although I loved America, these turned out to be 3 very difficult years for the rest of my family. My father was given a scholarship, but it was not a very generous one, and so we lived in an apartment in what was called the UCLA Married Student Housing. There were several poor married students, some with kids. There were also a few respectable international refugees who, more often than not, had fled their own countries as a result of a coup. And there was one Israeli couple who had 2 cats and with whom I would spend a great deal of time. My best friends were Vita from Tanzania, Berno from Ecuador, and Piyush from India. Vita's family lived on one side of our apartment. On the other was the Babikian family, Armenians from Lebanon. I remember the mother, Margot, and my mother became good friends. They also had a son who was younger than I, Ariel, with whom I would often play. The Army retirement plan was not generous at the time, and so money was very tight. Although I was never in want of anything, I realize now how hard and stressful it must have been on both my parents. I was always a cheerful young boy, and my mother, my sister Nurit, and friends of the family all made sure that I was having a good time, and I did. We would go to the pool on campus a lot and participate in summer camps there. My brother, Yoav, left after a year and returned to Israel. Nurit left shortly thereafter to study at the Sorbonne in Paris. Ossie, the sister closest to me in age, and I remained the entire 3 years. Realizing the amount of stress under which my father had placed himself and how his mood affected the rest of the family, my mother did her best to remain cheerful and make our life livable. When we first arrived in Los Angeles, we stayed in a very nice apartment building not far from UCLA. The apartment was spacious, and the corridors leading to it were carpeted like a plush hotel. There was a swimming pool, and since most of the residents were older, my sisters and I had it all to ourselves. But it turned out that my father's stipend could not afford us this arrangement, and we ended up moving into a smaller apartment on Sawtelle Boulevard among families who were younger and far less affluent. I knew no English when we arrived, but being six and having a TV set, I picked it up quickly. I went to second, third, and fourth grade at the Clover Avenue School in Los Angeles. I loved living in the U.S., and the experience gave me an edge that cannot be overstated. I became completely fluent in English, which made me bilingual at a very young age. I was exposed to American culture, and more than that, to the diverse nature of Los Angeles, and particularly the UCLA campus, during the late 1960s and early 1970s. I remember going with my father to the drive-in theater to see the famous fight between Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali, where Frazier knocked out Ali. When we returned, I saw that the entire neighborhood was in uproar, particularly the African Americans who lived there. More than a boxing match, this was a huge social and political match, even though both Frazier and Ali were African American. Ali represented the anti-war, anti-establishment African American rebellion of the time. His defeat was viewed as unfair and as a loss for the African-American struggle. We were also there during the presidential elections when Richard Nixon beat Hubert Humphrey. It's almost hard to believe today, but my father supported Nixon over Humphrey, as he supported the U.S. bombing of Cambodia and Vietnam because he was completely and thoroughly anti-communist and pro-American. Watergate began to surface during our final days in the U.S. Even after we returned to Israel, I kept up with American politics and culture, much more so than most Israeli kids my age. And I held on to certain pop culture associations from the time. Peanuts, I take it he means the cartoon characters. The young Michael Jackson. And all the television series and shows that marked that period and remained iconic in American culture. So that when I moved back to Southern California as an adult, I was in some ways returning home. My father had an office at UCLA on the 10th floor of one of the tall buildings on campus. And he spent most of his time there. In the evening, after dinner, he would watch the news, and then I would join him on the couch for an episode of Bonanza or the Wild Wild West or a police drama before going to bed. While I enjoyed America, I was glad to eventually return to Jerusalem. But in Israel, things did not go so smoothly for me. I had first grade Hebrew skills and was sent to fifth grade, but received no help in order to catch up. Plus, what was cool in the U.S. was not necessarily cool in Israel. Here, no one cared about UCLA beating USC at basketball. I knew nothing about local sports, and the American mannerisms I'd picked up made me an outsider from the get-go. The first day of school, my mother dropped me off at the house on 18 Roshba Street, our old building where my grandmother's now lived, and said, just follow all the other children. They are all going to the same school. I didn't know my way around, so I was terrified, but I did what she said. Then once I got to school, I had no idea where to go. There were hundreds of children who seemed like they knew what to do and where to go, and I was embarrassed to admit I was clueless. Eventually, I found my class, and the teacher gave me name cards to hand out to all the students, not realizing I could not read Hebrew well enough to read the names. The first couple of years back in Israel, my greatest fear was that I would be asked to read out loud and people would find out that I couldn't read very well. I fell behind in all subjects, and that, along with my father's unpopular views, made for some tough times for a 10-year-old. Because my father, the retired general, called for compromise and criticized the state, he was called an Arab lover, quote unquote, Arab lover, and so was I, although I still hadn't formed any particular political views. It's safe to assume that the other kids repeated at school what they heard at home, and it made little difference. It made little difference if I held the same views as my father or not. It took me 3 years to catch up, both socially and academically. By eighth grade, I felt pretty good, and I had a few friends. As far as school was concerned, other than English, with which I felt at ease, my confidence was always low and my performance poor. So while 3 years in the U.S. was a great opportunity, because no one thought to work with me through the transition, the return home was very difficult. Meanwhile, my father helped to found the Arabic Literature Department at Tel Aviv University. He gained a reputation as a serious and innovative scholar and later became the first Israeli professor of Arabic literature to introduce studies of Palestinian prose and poetry into the academic curriculum. He taught at Tel Aviv and Haifa universities until he retired for a second time in 1990. While we were still in the U.S., my father started writing a weekly opinion column in Ma'ariv, a mass circulation daily newspaper published in Israel. Because of his resume, everyone expected him to align himself with the Israeli government's narrative, which claimed that Israel had been viciously attacked by three Arab armies in 1967 and defended itself heroically because it had the wits and, more importantly, the moral high ground. This narrative also claimed that Israel's rights to the land of Israel were absolute, if not for religious or historical reasons, then for military and security reasons. But he saw things differently. He came out and stated publicly that the 1967 war was not an existential war, but a war of choice, saying this: I was surprised that Nasser decided to place his troops so close to our border. He must have known the grave danger into which he placed his forces. Having the Egyptian army so close allowed us to strike and destroy at any time we wished to do so, and there was not a single knowledgeable person who did not see that. From a military standpoint, it was not the Israeli Defense Forces that was in danger when the Egyptian army amassed troops on the Israeli border, but the Egyptian army. And that extraction from Mati Peled's The Beauty Has Not Faded, Ma'ariv, June 15, 1973. Perhaps from this point on, I will not pay so much attention to the footnotes of the book. Now, I don't want to confuse people, and I don't want to make any tediousness of this reading any longer or worse than it might be for some of you out there. Well, I'm in the middle, still very much in the middle of chapter 3. See what we can do here in the next couple of minutes. My father fiercely criticized the army's building of an expensive defense line in the Sinai Desert along the shores of the Suez Canal. He thought the army should be mobile and agile, and that throughout history, defensive lines had proven themselves to be costly and ineffective. This line was later named Kav Barlev, or the Barlev Line, after Chief of Staff Chaim Barlev. During the 1973 Arab-Israeli War, the Egyptian army stormed through the Barlev Line, and it proved to be a disaster, providing no defense at all. After the war, and keep in mind, folks, that's what he's saying here, was well into Egyptian territory. It was on the western edge of the Sinai Peninsula, all of which rightfully belonged to Egypt to begin with. Continuing now. After the war, everyone liked to joke. Question: what remained of the Barlev line after the war? Answer: the villas of the contractors who built it. In response to a comment made by Israel Galilee, who was a cabinet member and a major policymaker under Golda Meir's premiership, his name was Israel Galilee, my father wrote yet another article calling to allow the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza to conduct democratic elections. Galili's claim, often heard since, was that had there been democratically elected Palestinian representatives, Israel might have considered negotiations, but in the absence of such representatives, Israel had no choice but to maintain the status quo. My father thought Galili's claim disingenuous. After all, it was Galili's Israeli government that was preventing the Palestinians from conducting elections in the West Bank and Gaza. In another article my father wrote in his column on the third anniversary of the Six-Day War, my father compared the government's inaction and lack of courage to act to achieve peace, a peace that he said was made possible thanks to the tremendous victory that the army delivered, to the lack of courage and inaction that characterized the same government in the weeks leading up to the war. He wrote of the great sacrifice he, along with everyone else, felt in having to return portions of the land of Israel in return for peace. Quote, I would be less than honest had I denied that I too have deep regard for these lands that for the sake of peace must be left outside the boundaries of our state. And he continued to speak with great emotion of the experiences of his youth. It was not out of obligation, but rather love for this country that in my youth I traversed its length and breadth. Now, there is a long footnote here to the comment about the 1973 Mideast War that I wanted to read to you. The 73 War, also called the Yom Kippur War, began on the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur, October 6, 1973. Egyptian and Syrian forces attacked Israel and caught the IDF by surprise, which resulted in panic and many casualties. A special inquiry, the Agronaut Commission, was set up to investigate the IDF failings. It found IDF top brass responsible and several generals including the IDF chief of staff, had to resign. Prime Minister Golda Meir, who remained unscathed by the commission, had to resign as well as a result of popular protests. Continuing with the text. In 1973, Prime Minister Golda Meir gave a speech in the southern Israeli city of Eilat in front of an audience of high school students. It was during this speech that she claimed that, before 1967, she had never heard of the Palestinian people and that they were somehow invented and had no real national identity, and therefore could have no national claims to the land of Palestine. In his column, my father immediately wrote a scathing reply to Golda's speech, where he asked the following: how do people in the world refer to the population that resides in the West Bank? What were the refugees of 1948 called prior to their exile? Has she really not heard of the Palestinian people prior to 1967? In discussions she must have had over the years in her capacity as ambassador and then as foreign minister, how did she refer to these people? Yet she says she had not heard of the Palestinian people prior to 1967. Truly amazing. Okay, folks, I must discontinue now, as according to my aging memory, 2 hours have passed in the preparation and recording of this program. At the moment, it's Christmas night, 25 December. And I have recorded this for playback at 11 o'clock in the morning tomorrow, Saturday, the 26th. Continued readings of The General Son by Mikko Peled will continue every Saturday throughout the length of the book. Don't forget, you may respond to this program's email address, MideastMigraines@gmx.com. MideastMigraines@gmx.com. Please join me next week and I will continue with chapter 3. It's getting really interesting now, the really old stuff about his family and all the predecessory descriptions of where he came from in his boyhood, etc., and the important facts about his father's younger life, including up to the time he was a general in the Israeli army, are now behind us. We're getting into the real purpose of this book. So thanks again for joining me. I'm Ren Tawil, and until next Saturday at 11 a.m. or Monday at 3 p.m. for the other Mideast Migraines program, do what you can, but behave yourself.